My name is Clancy Emerson. I'm an alcoholic. The reason I delayed, I didn't know what was going on. I heard Clancy, but I didn't know what that meant. But thank you. I'm glad to be here tonight. I've been kind of sick all weekend. I got some bad food on the plane or something. And I go to the meetings, and in between the meetings, I go upstairs and lie down, and everybody else has fun and goes and sees things. And all I've ever known is pain. It's all right. And now tonight is the first night I really felt good again. I really feel good, and now it's too late. Well, hell with it. But anyway, I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to be safe and sane and sober, as I like to say. I'm going to tell you something. I said this before once, and Cliff heard it, but he left to hear it again, because it's kind of a sad thing that happens to people like me. A few weeks ago, I was in a city called Cincinnati at an airport. I was waiting for a plane, and I went into a washroom because I had to go to the back can. And I sat down in the washroom and doing my business quietly. And I heard a voice in the next stall say, "Hi there." Not that he can't mean me. There's only two stalls here, but he must be talking to somebody else. But he said, "Hi there. What are you doing tonight?" And I said, "Well, actually, I'm going to an AA meeting, and I'm going to speak at an AA meeting. It's no big deal, but why? What do you want to know?" He said, "You want to have a good time?" I said, "I don't know. What's going on with you, pal? Are you all right?" There was a pause. He said, "We could really have a good time tonight." I said, "Look, dummy, I'm just going to the can. I want to go to the meeting. Now, why don't you just shut up and leave me alone?" Then there was a pause, and the voice said, "I'll have to call you back. This guy in the next stall keeps talking to me." So what do I care if I've missed a trip to the Blue Lagoon? But we are gathered here to talk about alcoholism, as we all are at these meetings. And various... I was thinking today as I was listening to the speakers, I enjoyed them. I'm sure you've enjoyed them all. I listened to Cliff. I've heard many times. As he mentioned, I was his sponsor. And I remember Cliff when he was just a week or two sober and just kind of stumbling around, smirking still. And and Mary, when she was crying at all meetings, just, you know, you didn't have to lean over here, Mary, I want to wash my hands. You know. And a great many people have come and gone in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it really is remarkable. I know there's a lot of young people here and a lot of new people. I want to just take a couple of minutes to talk about what a remarkable thing it is that we're here. Now, most of us know the general history of AA, but a lot of people don't really understand what a series of funny little coincidences had to take place for us to sit in this room tonight. Now, as you know, they've been treating alcoholism or alcohol problems for hundreds and thousands of years. As long as there's been alcohol, there's been problems. There's always been a small group of people in every generation who has difficulty with it. They can't handle it. People wonder, what the hell's wrong with these people? And they used to flog them and lock them up and put them in nut houses, and not kind of recently for that, but sometimes they put them to death because they thought they'd been possessed by the devil or something. And in all these years, they've tried all sorts of therapies. And even by the time I was born, after all these thousands of years, there was no effective therapy. One of the great stories of all time, of course, is 1931. A very wealthy family in New York had a son who was in his mid-30s. And he was a bright boy, a nice man. He's working in the company. But he seemed to be very nervous, which they felt made him drink too much. They had to ascribe it to nerves because he was a good man. And so they found the best doctor in the world, and they're going to send him to see this doctor. Now, here's something most people don't know or have ever heard about. They called Dr. Freud and explained the case, and Dr. Freud in Switzerland refused to take the case, which is a lucky thing for you and me. because if he had, we'd be sitting here in the nut house talking about our dreams. So they went to his disciple who had broken with him, a guy named Dr. Jung. And Dr. Jung had a sanitarium in Switzerland. And said, yes, bring him over. So they brought Roland over there with a blank check. Do whatever you have to do to take care of our son. And Dr. Jung put him in the sanitarium and talked to him every day and worked with his deep emotional problems and psychological conflicts. At the end of a year, he really had him straightened out and saw the nature of his problems. And he released him to come home. And Roland stopped with some friends in Paris and was so happy and so elated. And they toasted his health with a glass of wine. And a few days later, Roland was face down drunk in Paris, rolling around in the spit. And his family was appalled. And he was appalled. He didn't know what had happened. And so they sent two guys over with a check to take him back to Dr. Jung. They took him back to Switzerland and said, didn't quite take, doctor. Could you do it again? And Dr. Jung refused to take him back into the hospital. Seemed kind of cruel. Again, that's although it saved our life. And they said, why? He said, why? Well, he didn't mean to do anything bad, doctor. He said, I know. He said, but I realize now I've misjudged Roland. He does not have the deep psychological problems that I thought he did. He may have them, but that's not his problem. He is what is known as an alcoholic. And to the best of my knowledge, there is no effective treatment for his condition in the world today at any cost. That was 1932, not that long ago, folks. And Roland was a little taken aback. He said, well, what does this mean, doctor? He said, well, it means that you will either have to keep yourself confined voluntarily or involuntarily as long as you live, or you almost certainly will drink intermittently until you die or go mad. And Roland was a little taken back. He said, well, that's kind of a bad prognosis to get. He said, is there no way out? He said, well, in the literature, there have been a few cases where there's been an involuntary psychological reversion somehow that they call a spiritual experience. But he said, I've never seen one, and I would not recommend you wait for one because they're very, very rare. And so Roland came home. He didn't stop in Paris for a victory dinner this time. And on the ship, on the way back to the United States, I guess he did something that all of us have to do for him to stay here, although he didn't know he was doing it. Most of us don't know we're doing it. He surrendered. He surrendered the fact that he was hopeless and helpless. And he came back, and he'd been a vestryman in the Presbyterian Church. He'd been quite active in the church, and it hadn't helped him. And he didn't know what to do. He wanted to find some spiritual movement, as he said, wrote later, I wanted to stay sober at least a while so that my parents would have a pleasant memory of me. And he found a thing called the Oxford Group, which most of you have heard of, maybe not be familiar with. The Oxford Group was kind of a, I don't know if you know what EST is, but it's a, the Oxford Group was kind of a upper middle class and better type people who got together in various communities to discuss spiritual things and how they could enhance their spiritual values. So he went to that. He figured maybe that'd help. And he stayed sober. He thought it was because of the Oxford Group, but many people in the Oxford Group didn't stay sober, probably because of his surrender. And he stayed sober for a while. His family was very pleased with that. And he probably wouldn't have if Dr. Jung would have taken him back another year. And he stayed sober for a while, and finally his parents said, gee, Roland, you're doing so well. In the summertime, we always used to go up to Vermont. Why don't you go up to our Vermont home up there and spend a while, see what's going on? So he went to Vermont to take a little vacation, celebrate his sobriety. And I'll tell you something. If he'd have gone 2 weeks earlier, we wouldn't be here. If he'd have gone 2 weeks later, we wouldn't be here, oddly enough. He went there, and the first week he was there, some people came up to him and said, you know, your friend that you used to know in the summertime here, Ebby, has really become a terrible drunk. And I know that you used to drink and now you're sober. Could you talk to him? He said, sure, I'll try. And everyone talked to Ebby. He said, you know, Ebby, if you get in the Oxford Group, you wouldn't drink anymore. And Ebby said, I don't want to hear that crap. You know, don't give me that. And so he said, okay, just thought I'd try. Well, the next week, Ebby got in a car accident. He ran his car drunk into somebody's house. And the problem was he was on very strict probation from the state court. And so they brought him to court to sentence him to the Vermont State Penitentiary. And they quickened, got Roland and said, Roland, come and try to help Bebe, because your dad and the judge knows, the guy that was asking him, his father was a judge. He had no influence with him. He said, but you and your dad, do go over and try to help Ebby a little bit. So he said, okay. I went to court since I happened to be there. And he said, Judge, I know that Ebby's done a very bad thing, and I know he's drinking heavily, but if you will release him in my custody, I'll take him back to New York and put him in the Oxford group, and maybe that'll help him. And the judge said, okay, but only because it's you. I would not do this for anyone else, but I know you and your father. You take him to New York. If he comes back to Vermont, he will go to the penitentiary. So take him to New York. So we took him to New York because he happened to be in town. He got him out of there. And he put him in the Oxford group, and he put him in a mission on Broadway where some of the lower class folks stayed. And he went to Oxford group meetings all the time. And he didn't really want to be there. He kind of thought it was crappy, but he didn't want to go to the Vermont penitentiary either. So this went on for a while. And one of the tenets of the Oxford movement was after you've been sober a while, or after you've been doing it a while, not sober, but you had to testify to someone. You had to find someone and tell them what you found. And he didn't want to do that. He said, Ebby's time to testify. I don't want to testify. Nobody, you want to go to Vermont? No, I want to testify. So he thought, who can I testify to that won't embarrass me? And he happened to think of this one rogue that he knew from Vermont, who was even a bigger bum than he was, turned out. And he lived in Brooklyn somewhere. And he was couldn't get a job. He was down and out last time he heard. He used to be a big shot. Now he's a bum. I'll go over and testify to him if I can find the bum. So he looked up and found out how to get a hold of a guy named Bill Wilson. And he made arrangements to go over and call on Bill Wilson. Now, in our book, Bill Wilson gives his version of it, kind of sanitized, about how Ebby came to the door and said, I've got religion. We sat down, and shortly thereafter, I was sober. But didn't really, I've heard Ebby talk. I heard him talk at the International Convention in 1960. And he had a slightly different version of that meeting. He come to the door, and and Bill invited him in, and they sat down, and they sat in the kitchen, and Bill, just to show his defiance, kept drinking all the time he was there. That's really wonderful, Ebby. And Ebby gave him a pep talk. It didn't do any good, and he went away. And here's something our book doesn't mention, but it actually is true. He didn't want to testify, but he hated to have that drunken bum put him down like that. So he came back 3 or 4 days later, and he had the Oxford group closer with him. You know, what are we going to do, Mr. Wilson? I'll tell you about the Oxford group. And Bill Wilson did what any decent alcoholic would do. He said, screw you in the Oxford group, and away off in a big, terrible drunk. And I don't want to hear that crap. But he wound up, he staggered around. Finally found the mission where Ebby was staying and went in there, and Ebby was there, but he gave a short sermon anyway, and marched on down the street and wound up terribly drunk again and sick, and they put him back in the hospital where he'd gone. And they called Bill's wife, and she called Ebby at this mission and said, Bill's in the hospital. And they rushed over there and talked to him. And he was so sick. I'm so sorry. I mean, you got to find a God. You can't find a God. That's ridiculous. He's so sick. And in the middle of the night, Bill Wilson, of all the people in the world who you'd ever guess wouldn't, had a spiritual experience. There's no justification for it. He wasn't worthy. Nothing. Just... that's how it happened. And he